I know we're going a little bit longer than we usually do. Maybe I won't ask a final question, but I really wanted to ask you to elaborate on what you're saying on Vernadsky. You breached the subject, so I'm going to just ask a short question on this subject. You made the point that since the beginning of the 20th century, mankind has been enslaved by a Zeusian system, by the Hilbert-Russell attempt to kill creative science. And during the 20th century, it's clear that Vernadsky was taking that on directly, that a Zeusian system, as opposed to a Promethean system, where mankind is a completely distinct species that's not of the purely biological animal domain, so-called, but a species that transcends all other species of living creatures. And Vernadsky most characteristically identifies the human species as absolutely distinct from beasts by his use of fire. In an essay that he wrote in 1938 called On the Scientific Thought as a Planetary Phenomenon, he writes, he says this explicitly. He says, "I believe that Homo sapiens, or his closest ancestors, were formed not long before the onset of the period of glaciation, or in one of its warmer periods. Man survived the severe cold of that period due to the great discovery that was made at that time in the Paleolithic age, the mastery of fire. The discovery of fire appears to be the first instance in which a living organism masters and makes himself the steward of one of the forces of nature. Undoubtedly, that discovery lies, as we now see, at the basis of the subsequent future increase of mankind and the forces now in his possession." So this is clearly a Promethean view of man, that man's mastery over the forces of nature, typified by his use of fire, makes him absolutely unique, and also that it's this mastery of fire which laid the basis for the entire future increase of the population and productivity of mankind. And so you stated in the discussion this past Wednesday on the weekly report that there really are no limits to the power of the human species. And in fact, we should be thinking about not just exerting mastery over the planet as a whole, but becoming stewards of the solar system in its entirety and eventually the galaxy and beyond. So in that context, maybe you can just say a final word about this mission of endless progress for mankind and how this allows us to transform our idea of mortality and immortality.
Okay. Well, the essentials are elementary. First of all, what's increased in power of mankind is actually located in the chemistry of the human individual. The human individual has nothing to do with the animal kingdom, because there's a barrier, a distinction, which no animal, mere animal, can meet, and nor ever will. Animals do not have a notion of the future. That's the difference. Now, where's this future come from? From in chemistry. It comes in chemistry. So instead of using the idea of abstract fire or some other medium, you have to think of what does this mean? It means that mankind is actually biologically, by using the principles of the increase of the periodic table, the same, that we increase the energy flux density by the development of man. So man becomes a conscious of a means of tool which no animal knows. And that is the creative powers of the human mind. No other beast except humanity has ever manifested to us in any form of record or indication the existence of progress of the species of this type, of growth to higher and higher levels of capability, except the human species itself. Now, we have two problems with this thing. One is people like to believe that they can measure it in terms of sense perception. Now, sense perception is not a competent instrument. sense perception is like a shadow rather than substance. And it's the substance you have to define. And this comes in where chemistry comes into place. Chemistry starts in the tables of chemistry, which is a 19th century idea, not a 20th century idea. So the 19th century development of the idea of chemistry was finding an order of different elements of the periodic table, or what became the periodic table, and sorting these things out into groups and creating a periodic table over the course of the 19th century. So therefore, at that point, we discovered that the chemical actions which correspond to those elements, which was discovered toward the end of the century, that these elements come in an assorted way of order of magnitude. So now when we try to understand mankind as a living species, we say, what's the characteristic of mankind's development, natural development? Is the fact that the human species has some kind of voluntary capability, which no animal has, to create the future by a conscious intention or an implicitly conscious intention. So mankind is always improving, probably, in his power, which means that as we go from the periodic table as it used to be, we've now gone into very higher energy flux densities of what we call as new replacements or superseding elements in the process of chemistry. This means we have now reached far beyond the capability of any ordinary source of chemistry. We have entered the area of a super chemistry, of increases in energy flux density of the content of action, controllable by man, by the human will. And these things now reach, in terms of experimental pilot testing, increase the power of the sun. That mankind's mind has now reached the point of an experimental work in which the power that mankind wields as science is capable now of designing instruments whose energy flux density will exceed the power of the sun. Which means, and this is the real punchline on this one, that mankind has reached a point where we no longer believe in sense certainty, or should no longer believe in sense certainty. We should recognize that man's idea of sense perception is a mirage. It's a mere shadow cast by something much more powerful, which is the essence of the human individual. That's something else. This something else, by the process of invention, is enabled, actually, and it's been proven in fact so far. What man can do by the human will in this way of increasing energy flux density, mankind is able to reach beyond Earth, as Aristophanes did, in identifying what the significance of the sun is for measuring Earth. Archimedes never understood that. He was floundering around still for a long time. And the people of the Renaissance had to fix this thing up because he was such an idiot on these matters. He was always Roman, but that was not good enough. So that Aristophanes was the one who understood this. It was Aristophanes who enabled the relatively dumb Archimedes how to apply what he discovered to mapping the region of the Mediterranean Sea. That was, he extended the experience of the sun, which he himself had perfected, and extended that so Archimedes could be instructed how not to be less stupid than he'd been so far. And this was the transition from Aristophanes' genius into the development of what became the Renaissance. So since that time, the idea of the spiritual feature in life is that what we call spiritual is a power which resides inside the human being, but which actually reflects something that the human being does not know by sense perception. We only knew it by achievement, by practice. We find that we are capable to synthesize by reflecting on the experience of progress of mankind through chemistry. And the way you measure this is in chemistry. To higher and higher chemistries. We use chemistry as a standard way of referencing this. But chemistry looks at us, first of all, as if it were objects. But it's not an object. It's a principle. It's the development of a principle, which the human mind can do. Once the human mind, like Aristophanes, says we are not going to measure events on Earth by living on Earth, we're going to take the shadow cast by the sun, and we're going to measure space beyond sense perception by that standard. So is this germ of science, which comes in that process and settles in the Renaissance itself, that is the source of modern science, as typified such that anyone who does not know that Kepler discovered the solar system is not qualified to be called a scientist. Anyone who rejects Kepler's authority as being the original discoverer of the principle of the solar system is an idiot and should not be trusted with scientific matters.
Well, with that said, we're going to bring a conclusion to today's webcast. Thank you very much, Lynn, and thanks, Cody, for joining me here. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Stay tuned. Good night.
So that was Lynn LaRouche on May 23rd, 2014, talking about my lab. Thank counts. And anybody else who gets a chance to participate in making what we make. Now, let's see who has come in during that broadcast. We have Leon. Is that you, Leon? I think that's Leon.
Yes, sir. How are you doing?
Very good, and Carolyn mentioned last night to me, you know, we haven't heard anything from Leon in weeks. Don't you think he should lead the show this week? I said, yes, that's a good idea, Dr. Dean. So we will be calling on you in a few seconds to carry the load here. LaRouche did a fine job and for 10 or so minutes. Then we have blocked, unavailable. What's that mean? Anyways, anybody under blocked? Anybody don't know who that is. And then Sean from England, and looks like Martin. You're speaking, the blog person. Is that Kate? You want to say something, Kate? Okay, there's an anonymous.
In a couple weeks. So it feels good to be back in around people who talk abnormally, but normally.
We use English.
Yes, exactly. Life's good over here. I'm preparing for my great escape off the island, and I'm gonna go on, move away closer to Ionette's.
Oh, really? Right. You're leaving Vancouver Island?
I am. Mm-hmm.
Oh, where are you going? You going to Vancouver?
I am.
Oh, I see. You and Chad are setting up domesticity. You're going to start a family, right?
Not necessarily, but to be close.
But where you're going to go start? Bother Chad. Are you going to live near him or in his building? How close are you going to bother him?
I'm going to be pretty close, but we're not living together or anything.
Right. Well, what about your gig? It's a great gig with the little babies.
There's no babies. No, there's no babies. There's young adults who need someone like me to rip them around.
Well, are they 10, 11?
Yes, around there.
So you're quitting that role?
Yes.
Got an idea what you want to do? What you're going to do?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm ready for, a change.
Okay.
Hmm. I met Wendy. And
I know. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. So in 1 week, I met two more INETs. And it's
what
so
was that? You said in 1 weekend? In 1 weekend, you met two more INETs, two?
Yeah, in 1 week. Yeah, in the last week. I met MJ and Wendy.
Oh, no. You met MJ? Jeez, don't put that on your resume.
It was awesome.
In what way? I mean, this
I don't know.
Got you so addled. So addled. I mean, this is where it proves we're not a cult here, because no cult would allow this kind of activity going on here.
Why not? It's awesome because we can go meet people in the cult. And then we can talk about you and laugh our heads off because you're the funniest man on the planet. And
yeah,
all share something in common, which is, you know, I and Dumb and talking about it. It feels so good to talk about it in person with somebody else.
Right. Okay, well, I'm interested in that. What aspects of me were laughed about?
Well, we just would bring up things that you'd say, and just hearing other people's perspective on it. It's funny. It gets funny. It gets really funny because you're Bob.
Yeah,
like, to have more people in one room know who Bob is, it's really funny.
Yeah, that's I think Jermaine understands that. She's had that experience, right, Jermaine?
Yeah, plenty of times.
Okay, so tell us about MJ. Well, no, what about Wendy? What did you learn from Wendy, or what did Wendy learn from you?
Well, she, like, I think when she was telling me about when she first started engaging, I reminded her of me, and she reminded me a lot of her. Like, I feel like I have a lot in common with her.
Oh, yeah?
Our outlook on life and everything, and I don't know, she just gave me really good advice about, you know, just not giving up, and even though I might feel that I don't get it and it's just not making any sense, like, just keep listening anyway, keep calling
right.
in anyway, talk, even though you might give me a hard time and call me a fuckface
yeah.
alcoholic or whatever, just continue, because
yeah.
you don't
yeah.
you're not going to remember that to me anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
And
I don't remember.
And just seeing how through her day, how she notices anomalies, points them out, tells stories about her experiences, and I can relate. And it's also funny. Like, it just, there's never anything, like, when you're around INETs, there's never anything negative to talk about. Like, it just flows so beautifully, naturally, and openly. Like, it's like when we meet, it's like we've known each other for a long time,
yeah.
even though we've just met.
Nice.
Yeah.
And did you stay overnight with her, or just spend all day
with
her?
Just the day, like, for a few hours, maybe 4 hours or so. But she
and
showed me the
pointing out anomalies.
Yes, on her walk and on her daily walk and on her, you know, in the grounds that she
yeah.
She says they're all ionic and, you know, the room that she told me that I would be sleeping in has the Sheila's paintings in them. So that was the first time I saw them in real life.
Oh yeah.
And, yeah, they're so beautiful, and I don't know, she's just really, really kind person, and she lives in a beautiful house, and she's so sweet. She's so sweet! Like, I felt like we're like sisters or something. She's smiling, and she's a very generous, kind woman.
Okay, now, this is, you said her paintings are in her room, or did you say your room? What was
the
that?
Room that
her room?
I would sleep in if I stayed with her.
I see, the guest room.
Yes.
You would have slept with the paintings. Hmm.
Yes.
So as an artist, you're an artist, you're a good artist in the conventional sense. You haven't got an idea in a brain in your head, but you can paint. do the technical stuff. What did you think of Sheila's work?
Wow, so detailed, and it's just like so balanced. Like you can stand there in front of it for an hour and look at the whole thing, but an hour later you'll find something new about it that you didn't even notice. You know, the whole time you're staring at it, and probably if I had my own copy and I looked at it every day, I'd find something new about it that I found mm-hmm. very interesting.
And yeah, you have seen them before. You've seen them online, right?
Yeah, but I didn't. But when I saw it, like physically in person, it was different than looking at it just on like a laptop or something. It's so different, actually.
Great.
Yeah.
And did she have four or three?
She had two.
What?
For what? Painting?
How many paintings did she have of Sheila?
She had two.
Two. That would be the Labyrinth of the Mind and the Ascent, the throne one, sitting on
yes.
the throne. Right.
The Labyrinth painting yes. is incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then, so when
Could you paint the Labyrinth? If you were told to do that, make a copy, have you got the skill to imitate that exactly?
Yes.
You could.
I'm going to say yes.
So what is unique about what makes it Sheila's then?
Well, I mean, if you look closely up at the little pictures that she drew inside the labyrinth,
yeah, right.
I could still paint those little images, but they would look a little bit different. Like my style of drawing a lamb or a lion with wings, you know. But I'm saying, like in general, like to paint if I was told by Ion, you know, all the ways to paint it. If I never saw hers and we were both given the same instruction, I'm actually curious if it would turn out quite the same.
Hmm.
That's interesting.
I mean, you don't know.
That. But look, when I look at it, I would probably have a different technique of bringing it to life, but in general, I think it would be quite similar.
Right. And,
I didn't really look at that painting before, and then when I talked to Chad about it and he explained more about it, it's incredible. Like, I didn't really understand the whole labyrinth thing and, like,
yes.
why our labyrinth. I didn't really get it. But it's starting to make sense.
Yeah. All right. And, okay, so now MJ, did he feel like your brother?
Yeah, because like when he was sitting there, like I just wanted to give him a big hug all the time.
Right.
I don't know why. I just wanted to give him a hug. Like he just seems so huggable and lovable, and like super chill, and super relaxed. Like, yeah, he just. I don't know.
Did you say really super chilled?
Yeah, like chilled out and like.
Right.
Just go with the flow, you know, not confrontational or anything. We'll listen. He seems like a really good listener.
Did he complain about his relationship to Iandom?
No, not at all.
He didn't go into it.
No.
You know, self-pity or anything?
No.
Okay. Well, that's pretty good. So you're going to move. How soon is this going to be?
Hopefully in the next month.
And your employers, they don't mind?
I haven't mentioned it yet.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Now, you were in Calgary. Did you visit your parents?
I did.
Did you talk to them about me?
I did.
Ah, that would be interesting.
I can't help it. Like, I can't bring you up.
So how did it come up? What did you say?
That guy! Like, you still talk to that guy?
They complained.
Well, they're like, maybe next time we go to Hawaii, he won't even be here. They still can't cope that with your age.
Right.
I'm a offended by age and everything. And then they wanted to know, you know, just because I mentioned that I've been listening to your show, and they just wanted to know, like, what kind of things you talk about that I'm so intrigued with. Why is this Bob character? So I just say you talk about life events. Get it. But, you know, after being there, it feels really good to be back in BC, away from them. I really don't like Alberta at all. I couldn't handle it there. And, because BC, I can see why it stands for Bob and Carolyn. And especially in
what did you just say? What did you say? Oh, BC stands for Bob and Carolyn. Yeah, that's right. Very good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it feels like, I feel like a totally different person when I'm here. Like, it's like I changed into a totally different person. Do you think that's another me? Do you think I go through a portal or something? Or is it just...
It could be, but it's also, BC is very different. I definitely noticed that when I was there. The very nice place, a nice, comfortable environment, feeling be way different than Calgary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. At least it's the environment. You might be adding other aspects of it. That's a question you can ask Aya.
And when I go visit Chad, like in his little, like this place where he stays on the Ionic grounds of UBC, it's all like a totally different world than the rest of Vancouver.
Yeah.
And it feels different, and I don't know, the people are all like robots. So, because there's, like, a lot of Chinese people, and they're, like, robots. So, and it seems like since I've been going there, there's been less and less people, and it feels so quiet. Like, we're the only ones that live there.
In a big forest. The campus on a huge forest.
Yeah.
Well, that's very nice. Okay, so... Unless Jermaine has something to say, we are going to force Leon to talk. He hasn't said anything.
No, I want to hear Leon. Game.
You want to hear Leon. Okay, Leon, leave the show for a while.
Hi, Leon.
Hey, how you doing, love?
We have to meet up.
MJ would say.
I know, this was a slow response there.
Yeah.
How are you, Leon? Lead.
All right, it's talking about the 18 debate thing. Is that okay?
What did you say? We've got to get you to. We got to be able to understand you. What's your opening line?
The 18 in the Bay.
The you want to go to that? Okay. Right.
Are we dropping?
Okay.
It?
No, anybody can talk about it anytime they want.
All right. Well, I thought this was interesting because you guys brought up some unique insights last week, and I thought that was, like, something that a lot of these school districts and schools do. They're, like, they try to find kids that are, like, artistic or can actually, like, speak about what's going on, and then they, like, get them and do some silly little project, something like this. But as I noticed, usually a lot of authority figures after the kids wrote these particular, rules and regulations or codes of ethics to get through high school, that the at least the teachers will go back over it and they'll look through it, and then they'll fine-tune it to their likings. So therefore, it won't be like, I feel any problems for the school districts.
I might have missed a few words. What did you say?
Well, like, sometimes, like, when they do these particular projects, they always find someone or authority figure will actually go through it and, like, proofread it to make sure there's nothing too obscure or obscene about it that can get that.
How do you know that?
In trouble. Sometimes a lot of schools do that, because when I was in school, they did that sometimes. They would commission kids to, like, I don't know, do something for youth or upcoming potentials to the schools. So sometimes it will be like, all right, talk about how do you feel about high school? What are certain rules and things that you would like or that you feel that is very important to get through high school?
Right.
So
and you detect that this happened here. It's being
edited. It's the same project, but it's just now online, and it looks a little bit more professional.
What do you mean it's the same project? The same as what? Something you did?
Something that I was familiar seeing going on in high school, or even school itself in general.
Hmm. Okay. So what's that mean for you, that this is phony?
It's written by young kids, but it's just, once again, going through some authority figure. So, like you kind of have to read through it a little bit finer than usual.
Mm.
Still some of the vocabulary words that they use is, it's still like PG. It's not that bad.
Mm. PG, what's that? Parental guidance?
There you go, yeah. So it's still almost universal. It's not as bad, but just, you know, if you're 16 and older, you can look at this. Your parents won't feel so bad about it.
Oh,
right, so you would like
filtered.
It to be...
Yes, there you go. Thank you, Jermaine. Filtered, that's the key word. It's been filtered.
So that you would rather have it not be filtered?
No, I think both of it is good because, you see what these kids are going through. I mean, they have their opinion, but then they still have to, get filtered as they go through school just to make sure they graduate. Because these kids seem enthusiastic. I mean, they actually wrote or been part of a project.
Right. Well, so what? What?
So
that's pretty boring.
Yeah, I know. But I was just throwing that out there just so therefore, if people read the... Because I don't know who, Chad sent this to. But,
Did you go through most of it, Leon?
Pretty much so. I went through, some of the essays. I went through the charts. I went through, just whatever they kind of threw up there. It seemed like it got bigger. They keep adding more and more to it, such as, the daily upkeeps for... social media. But in other words, the basic stuff they started off with, some of the rules, and then they had that huge, you read that last week, Bob, and then they had a few essays about kids or certain parents, stories, tragic issues and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Tumblr hasn't been updated.
What was that again?
The Tumblr doesn't look like it's been updated. I just clicked on it, and it's the same as when we last went through it.
Oh, the 18 in the bay?
I see what, yeah. I can see what you're getting at.
I mean, it's a big project. It's nice, but I was just it doesn't hold anything. But you guys mentioned that last
shocking.
Week. I was asking, are you? Yeah, it's nothing too shocking about it. But I was asking, was you guys really dropping us, or were you going to go into a little deeper?
I'm not motivated to, but I think Chad, he might want to. If Chad wants to look into it, for some reason I find it boring. Let's see. Did I send that? This LaRouche, I played, a bit of that statement, the closing part. Here's what he says earlier in the that speech, May 23rd, 2014. He says, the human species is unique. The human species is not determined by time. It's pretty interesting. Not determined by time. The human species is governed by the rate of increase of the intensity of energy flux density of mankind on the planet. What we need to do is to have a society which is oriented toward true discovery, toward true progress, which means exactly that. Anyways, the words are nice. He says the correct situation. And you notice how he went on about chemistry and the sun. We're more powerful than the suns right now technologically. I don't know of anything that's going on where that applies other than Iandom. We're bigger. Oh, what's that? Somebody shaving? Brushing their teeth?
Fire.
Who's that? Is that your background, Kate?
Oh, it's not me.
I think it's mine. It's my computer. I'm calling from my laptop. It's probably overheating.
Really? Would make it sound like that?
No, it's coming from mine, though. I think it's like the sound.
Okay, I'm going to block you. I'll block you, see if it stops. Yeah. And you're back on. Are you on speakerphone?
No, I'm on my earphones. I was trying to Skype and it didn't go through, so I stayed on calling from my laptop. But I can call from my phone. It's going away.
Yeah, I sent you the Skype information, right?
Yeah, I tried it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tried it, but it didn't work for me.
Okay, can you stay on your computer and then call your phone?
We should
compare.
Can you still hear the noise?
Not now. No, yeah, what caused that?
I think I've had my laptop on all day, connected, but I just disconnected it, and now it went away.
Okay, good. But, you know, you're on there. You could pick up your phone and call in on another line, and we could compare.
Okay, I can do that.
Yeah, just keep this one open. Then use your phone. Okay. Let's see. I think your phone causes all kinds of static, too, doesn't it?
I never know anymore.
Okay, you're clear now. You're actually, you know, stay that close to your computer.
Okay. Clear.
Yeah, this is good. We don't need to do the phone call. If you can stay like that.
All right.
So, Chad won't be here until 7, till the second hour. What do we have to... I have something maybe interesting to read. OJ sent me this. This is an article by McLuhan about 1960, where he reviews a book on Wyndham Lewis by Hugh Kenner, who was a student of McLuhan, and benefited a lot from McLuhan. Hugh Kenner went on to become a famous critic in the United States. He was a Canadian, but he moved to the States. So this is McLuhan appraising what Kenner points out in Kenner's book on Wyndham Lewis. Which book came out about 1958-59? I have that book. I even have this review, but this is convenient. Because somebody has posted it somewhere. Okay, so I'm going to mute everybody, and so we don't have too much noise. Might unmute halfway through or third through.
All participants are now muted.
Talking about Wyndham Lewis. It says, most of this book is devoted to the novels of Wyndham Lewis, and consequently to a discussion of characters, plots, and the Lewis theories of person, self, society, and the artist. It is an unfriendly book, but it also presupposes much familiarity with the work of Lewis. For the unprepared reader, the book is not likely to lead to a closer inspection of Lewis. That, however, one hopes may prove not to be the case. I remember Kenner wrote an article on Lewis in 1953, and McLuhan objected to it. I think McLuhan doesn't like the direction Kenner has taken, even though they were close colleagues, and they both went to St. Elizabeth Hospital in Washington in 1948. And on my father's birthday, June 4th, they met Ezra Pound together. So they had a past. So here is McLuhan saying, Lewis is in most respects the most eminent British painter of this century. His writings, Kenner admits, constitute, quote, the most astonishing literary career of the 20th century, unquote. Lewis is the man, quote, this is what he's quoting Kenner, Lewis is the man, quote, to whose mind the Cartesian split and the Nietzschean, that's Nietzsche, and the Nietzschean energy were not hobbies but lifeblood, unquote, and who, quote, was better equipped than anyone else to write out of inner knowledge the tragedy of his time, which would be the first half of the 20th century, unquote. Then McLuhan says, Lewis has this kind of representative importance. To an exceptional degree, his work has raised to the level of intelligibility what T.S. Eliot described as the, quote, dissociation of sensibility, unquote, that set in late in the 16th century. McLuhan would later say, or around that time say, the dissociation of sensibility was caused by the printing press. Now here's Lewis. McLuhan's reviewing Lewis, and Lewis has already influenced McLuhan and Harold Innes to invent the discipline of media ecology. So keep that in mind. So then McLuhan says, for Lewis has accepted, along with W.B. Yeats, Ezra Pound, and T.S. Eliot, the doctrinaire premises which produce the Cartesian split. In a word, his triadic, means triangular, his triadic view of spirit, intellect, and sense is the Neoplatonic and Buddhist view of the opacity of the intellectual knowledge and the illusory character of the human self. So the this would also include Gnosticism. The Gnostic Neoplatonic Buddhist view doesn't see much hope for intellectual knowledge and considers the self an illusion. So he's saying a lot of these vortices, Yeats, Pound, and Eliot, and Lewis, are agree with this view. And then McLuhan says, in this view, Neoplatonic and Buddhist, there is no vitality or reality in mind or self or the world. But art is of the spirit, the divine spark in man, which is not the self in this doctrine, and art alone can impregnate the world with some quality of reality. Then McLuhan says about himself, I may not be untypical of most Catholics in having been slow to apprehend this matter. So I may not be untypical. So it's typical of Catholics to meet the, to understand the role of art or to understand the role of Gnosticism. But the Romantics and the Symbolists, and the Romantics were the first Romantic revolution, that's Keats, Shelley, and those guys. And the second Romantics are the Parisians, Rimbaud, Baudelaire, and others. They're the second Romantics, in McLuhan's terms, and they're called the Symbolists. So he says, but the Romantics and the Symbolists, so that covers the whole 19th century, necessarily regarded art as more real than the external world. The Catholic doctrine of the body-soul composite confers a substantiality on the existent such as it had in no other view, pagan or heretical. So he's saying the Catholic view is that the physical world is more real than any pagan philosophy or heresy or Buddhism. All pagan religion and philosophy reposes immediately or ultimately on the doctrine of pre-existence. That leads into the idea of reincarnation. The core of this doctrine is the notion that man imprisons an uncreated divine spark within his body and within his soul. But the human self is no more identical with this bit of a divinity within us than the same spark is identical with a stick or a stone. So the human self is not connected to this spark of divinity, just as the spark of divinity is not in the stick or stone. But the imagination of the poet or genius is more nearly identical with this bit of divinity within us, so it's more identical, the imagination, than the same spark is identical with, what the heck? So he says the same thing, it's not the exact sentence, but then the same spark is identical with a stick or a stone. So the human self is no more identical, but the imagination is more nearly identical. Then he repeats that phrase, if this is correct, with this bit of divinity within us, then the same spark is identical with a stick or a stone. The imagination of the poet or genius is nearly identical with this uncreated spirit. The least vision or action of the genius is thus more real than all the rest of existence. Then McLuhan says, these views flooded, these Gnostic views flooded into Europe in the 15th century. It's interesting, we just had LaRouche speak. LaRouche would take the same view as McLuhan here, basically an anti-Gnostic view. These views flooded into Europe in the 15th century. They underlie all the mechanic materialisms from Descartes to John Dewey. John Dewey was an educational philosopher, first half of the 20th century. Since it is the merest whim whether these views are used to structure a Berkeleyan idealism, that's Berkeley, or a, you know, 1800s, say, yeah, 1700s, or a Darwinian mechanism. So, since it is these, they underlie all the mechanic materialisms. Now, McLuhan's not for mechanic materialisms. From Descartes to John Dewey, since it is the merest whim whether these views are used to structure an idealism or a mechanism, a Darwinian mechanism. In this respect, Thomas Hobbes, he was the philosopher who said might is right. In this respect, Hobbes was no more a materialist than Marx. Both regarded matter as an irreducible mental state. But mental states might well change with some rearrangement of the cosmic powers or eons. And it is the business of the artist to be constantly shifting the scenery of existence about, shifting about, in accordance with his infallible intuitions of the cosmic weather. Art is revolution. So that's this view. In this respect, Hobbes was no more a materialist than Marx. Both regarded matter as an irreducible mental state, but mental states might well change with some rearrangement of the environment or cosmic powers or eons. And it's the business of the artist to imitate that shifting. So it could be that the medium as a message is a Gnostic idea. Certainly media cause revolution. So art is revolution. McLuhan says media are art forms. Then he says this is also the Coleridgean, or Samuel Taylor Coleridge, notion of imagination. Fancy is for Coleridge. The imagination is understood merely in the tradition of Christian philosophy. The creative imagination in the Christian tradition is an intellectual power, not a superhuman emanation from spirit, spirit in quotes, or from the uncreated dark spark in the human soul. Okay, so he's now saying the non-Gnostic view, which is that the creative imagination in the Christian tradition is an intellectual power, not, as he said earlier, intellectual knowledge is opaque. So it is, it's an intellectual power, but is not a superhuman emanation from spirit or from an uncreated divine spark in the human soul. So McLuhan's laying out what he tends to believe. And he's saying Coleridge has a similar Gnostic notion, but it's within the Christian tradition. On the other hand, Lewis, like Eliot, Yeats, and Pound, the vortices, assumed the Pythagorean and Neoplatonic doctrine of spirit and imagination as a divine or superhuman power. That's not the Christian view. This power is no part of the human soul or intellect, but merely imprisoned there. The tragedy and comedy of the human condition is a result of the juxtaposition of this divine spark juxtaposed with matter, sense, and intellect. A familiar existentialist conception necessarily involving the doctrine of preexistence. So the Gnostic says there is a tragedy and comedy of the human condition, and it's a result of the juxtaposition of this split, separate divine spark with matter, sense, and intellect. And that leads to existentialist ideas and involving the doctrine of preexistence. Lewis makes great and grim comedy of the horror of spirit shackled to the dying animal or human body. His own point of view in comedy is expressed as opposite to Henry Bergson's when Lewis says that laughter results from the spectacle of things, that is, persons, trying to behave as though they were alive. Bergson found the key to laughter in persons behaving as though they were things. Bergson had not the courage of his own philosophical position. And it's precisely the courage of Lewis in pushing the Cartesian and Plotinian, that's about 300 A.D., Plotinist, that's Gnostic, pushing the Cartesian and the Plotinian angelism to the logical point of the extinction of humanism and personality that gives his work such importance in the new age of technology. For, on the plane of applied science, we have fashioned a Plotinian world culture which implements the non-human and superhuman doctrines of Neoplatonic angelism to the point where the human dimension is obliterated by sensuality at one end of the spectrum and by sheer abstraction at the other. So McLuhan is saying that the electronic technology are making a Gnostic world, or making people think it's unreal, as the Gnostic philosophy had done for thousands of years. This situation became so evident to Lewis in 1920 that he devoted the next two decades to warning us about and explaining the anti-human nihilism emanating from modern philosophy and physics. So McLuhan's saying that Lewis is a Gnostic, but he's against the Gnosticism that's happening around him, as well as, okay, emanating from modern philosophy and physics, as well as our everyday activities in commerce and social engineering in this century. Lewis's political and social analysis pursued a humanist course, but his art remained on the plane of the doctrinaire superhuman level of abstract art and Neoplatonic spirit. So Lewis is sort of split in his own activities. His intellectual analysis of society is not Gnostic. It's against the Gnostic effect of technology, but his art is Gnostic. Lewis's uncompromising exposés of nihilism in the time philosophers, like James Joyce, Bergson, and the positivists. The positivists are the regular accepted mainstream scientists. His uncompromising expose of nihilism in their work went parallel with an artistic nihilism which gave spiritual force to his humanist pamphleteering, and spiritual is in quotes. So his expose of nihilism in the technological environment and the thinkers of that environment went parallel with an artistic nihilism which gave spiritual force to his humanist pamphleteering. The result was that his double talk, so there's a double talk contradiction, angered elites who were playing the same games, while his art frightened the ordinary public. So Lewis frightened the ordinary public, and his complex essays angered the elites who were playing the same games of double talk. So then he brings up the novel that Lewis had done that year. Well, if this book comes out, no, this book, I know Hugh Kenner met Lewis in 57. So that's before he did the book. So I'm not sure when this book was done, 58, 59, 1960. But Lewis himself did a novel in 1954 about his stay in Toronto, and subsequently St. Louis, United States. I don't know if that's Missouri or Kansas, during World War II, because Lewis was in exile. He exiled himself because he knew he might be arrested in London for apparent Nazi sympathies. So this book is called Self-Condemned, and it's about, a good chunk of it is about his relationship with Marshall McLuhan. So here's McLuhan mentioning a book where McLuhan is a character in the book. And I was just talking to Ben Pelton. He has bought the book. Ben occasionally calls in here. And Ben is reading Self-Condemned. So McLuhan in this review says, a case in point is Lewis's current novel, Self-Condemned, which is set in Toronto and at Assumption College in Windsor. I think that may be the college that Chad went to. It became the University of Windsor. Definitely Chad lived in this area around Windsor. Lewis's central character, René, meaning reborn, and also my father's name, René Harding, flees the success that he's won in England as a historian and sets out on a quest of self or soul annihilation. So that would be a Gnostic trend. He thus, so René thus defies the gods in the manner of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Ancient Mariner. And I quote the Ancient Mariner in my book, Fatty Communion, where McLuhan says about him and Ted Carpenter, quoting the Ancient Mariner, "We were the first to burst into that silent sea." So the character René Harding based on Wyndham Lewis. He refuses to accept his full term or sentence in the human condition. So he's not accepting his Gnosticism, I guess. He willfully seeks the subhuman conditions of a colonial metropolis, that's Toronto, as a means of freeing himself from the merely human fetters of comfortable English life. So are you having fun, Carolyn, ripping your mail? Can you guys hear Carolyn rip her mail? Oh, I muted.